This isn't some abstract question. These are actually people's jobs, people's livelihoods, people's life chances, people's families we're talking about. And I say, don't put them at risk. Don't take this leap in the dark.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. In the week that the Beatles producer George Martin died, we have a look at another Beatle whose time was not allowed to run its course. The brains behind the band John Lennon was assassinated in New York in 1980 under a US intelligence program called COINTELPRO, counterintelligence propaganda for short. We find out what he thought about voting for mayors. And the Turkish government send the police in to take over the country's biggest opposition paper, which just happens to be publishing evidence of the president's corruption. We hear from the English edition's executive editor an exclusive interview. Plus, two big anniversaries of great British cover-ups this week. It's 30 years since the 1986 assassination of Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme, and also 20 since the Dunblane murders of 20 Scottish primary school children and their teachers by paedophile suspect Thomas Hamilton, who overruled the police advice for him to have his gun licence taken away. Plus, Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. But we start this week by looking at the final English film made by one of Britain's greatest ever comedians, Rick Mayall. Why has it still not been shown through most of our cinemas or on British television? Could it be because Rick plays a character with controversial views about the war on terror? Well, I'm joined by Diane Jessie Miller now on the line. At least I hope I am. Hi, Diane. Welcome to the Politics Show. We'll have to try that a little bit later in the show. Maybe we can start, Martin, by having a look at Libya and the takeover of that country we were talking about earlier on.
Well, as I understand from what Obama's been saying, is he was not that keen to get involved in the attempt to overthrow Gaddafi, which is effectively what it was. It was talked about as a humanitarian mission to prevent the Libyans using air power against demonstrators in Benghazi, although there's no evidence that they did in fact use air power against demonstrators in Benghazi. As the Russians pointed out, their satellites showed no evidence that the Libyans were using air power against demonstrators. Of course, that you wouldn't use air power against demonstrators, there's not really much point. So Obama is kind of saying, well, it's the British and the American, the British and the French were leading from the front here, and they insisted that we should try and overthrow Gaddafi. I was a bit iffy about it, but I'm now complaining because you didn't do enough subsequently to, help us to stabilise the situation in Libya. Now, in actual fact, I think everybody's dissimulating here. I think the plan to take down the Gaddafi regime was put together in advance. We know that Operation Southern Mistral 2011 was a British and French air war game based in the south of France, which was very, very similar and was just about ready to go just as the demonstrations broke out in Libya. Then the call for a no-fly zone was made, and in actual fact that was part of the war game Southern Mistral 2011, which people can look up online if they don't believe this. So in other words, there was an orchestrated plan to take down Gaddafi, which involved both the British, the French, and I believe the Americans. I think that Obama is being disingenuous there. But of course, the other factor that's problematic now for the Americans is the Benghazi incident when their ambassador was assassinated, and Hillary Clinton, of course, is in the firing line from the Republicans in the US about that. And of course, what they were doing there, what's come out if you read between the lines, is that they were getting Islamist militants and Islamist and weaponry from the Libyan army and they were being shipped from Benghazi to Syria via Turkey. So both weapons and militants were going. So Abdul Hakim Belhaj, who was the head of the Islamic fighting group in Libya, then turns up in Syria as a field commander for the so-called Free Syrian Army, even though he's actually a native of Benghazi. But of course somebody like him has been in and out of custody, but has actually been working with British intelligence services for many, many years. So there's an awful lot of sleight of hand and delusion going on here. But nevertheless, it should also be clear to most people that the intervention in Libya was A, illegal, and B, catastrophic. Thousands of people died, and all we've done is created another mess, just like Iraq. And of course, as Hillary Clinton said about Gaddafi, we came, we saw, he died. Now, that is simply illegal. I mean, Gaddafi was shot through the head with a bayonet up his backside by militants probably working with French special forces.
The situation today, Martin, is the United Nations is just saying today ISIS in Libya is presenting itself as the key bulwark against any kind of action by Western powers there. So ISIS is starting to thrive over there in the chaos that's been left since the removal of Gaddafi.
Well, I would argue that the evidence piles up that ISIS, both in Libya and elsewhere, is being surreptitiously manipulated by Western intelligence services. What they're providing is another excuse for the Western powers to intervene. And do you know what they're going to do? They're going to seize the oil industry to make sure that it doesn't fall into ISIS hands, because as we know, in Syria they got hold of the oil industry, and that was what funded them for years. But it only funded them for years because the Turkish military and the Turkish government were allowing them to ship the oil out of Syria and sell it on the international black market, mainly to the Israelis. And of course this is all shadow play and manipulation. Underlying all of this, as the Russian general staff well know, as the Iranian general staff well know, is that most militant Islamist groups are being funded and directed by Saudi Arabia, by Qatar and the other Gulf countries, which are not democracies by any stretch of the imagination, and by NATO intelligence services, including MIT in Turkey, CIA and MI6. And then we say, oh, look, we've got to go invading these countries to try and stop ISIS, whereas everybody who's objectively looked at it realises that ISIS and the Western intelligence services are effectively the same organisation.
I mean, is it really just all about oil?
Yes, to a large extent it is. It's about...
Why? Why is oil so... I mean, are we just addicted to this stuff?
Well, it's not a question of us being addicted to it. The main purpose of intervention in Africa and the Middle East by the Western powers is to prevent the Chinese getting her hands on the oil.
So all these
And
people...
also, of course, the main purpose of the war in Syria is to build a pipeline, a gas pipeline, through Syria from Qatar, which will then prevent the Russians being the main suppliers to the East, to the Europe, the Western Europeans. So it's all about pipelines and geostrategic manoeuvrings. And this is not so much to do with we want the oil, it's more, or the gas, it's more to prevent our geopolitical opponents from getting their hands on the oil and the gas.
So if a country's left in chaos,
yes,
then
it doesn't
you can't
matter.
Do these things.
Yes, indeed. And so the minimum, if you drive a country to chaos and drive them off the international oil market...
You're going to end up with the whole of the Middle East in chaos.
It's already happening, and you know, the people are on the move, as we know, arriving in Greece as we speak at 3,000 a day. And that is the result of our disastrous policies over the last 20 years under various regimes in this country. And, you know, all of those chickens are coming home to roost in a big flock, aren't they?
BCFM. Well, hopefully I've got Diane Jessie-Miller on the line now. Hi, Diane. Welcome to the Politics Show. We'll try again.
Hello, how you doing?
Oh, fantastic.
Yes. You can hear me now. Technology, it's our saviour and our fear. It's all manner of things.
Well, so, well yes. Done. Thanks for getting to us on the phone. Skype sort of let us down. But anyway, this film, am I right in saying that this was the very last film that he made in Britain, Rick Mayall?
It was his last UK feature, yeah. He did another film afterwards, a Dutch feature, but I believe he only plays a cameo in it, but I don't know because I've not seen it. But yeah, this is what I'm led to believe is the last major film role that he did, especially in the UK.
Can you just tell us what it was like to work with him? Because I know that you were kind of an amateur filmmaker, weren't you? You come to this kind of fresh, without going through the kind of professional industry. What was it like working with Rick?
It was amazing to work with someone like Rick. I mean, I got very lucky getting Rick involved in it. Like you said, it was a first-time filmmaker. I mean, I didn't write any short films or anything. I went straight into features because this subject spoke to me, or these subjects spoke to me so much that I wanted to get them into the masses. So when I wrote the script, we knew we had to get somebody of some kind of notoriety in it to give it the clout that it might need. And Rick was one of the choices, and we got really lucky. He went through his agent, so not through a back door or anything like that, straight through the front door. His agent sent him the script on the Friday, and I got a phone call on the Monday saying that Rick wanted to do it based on the script.
Fantastic. Well, let's have a little listen to a clip from the film now. Hope you don't mind me borrowing a little bit of your copyright. And this is where there's a discussion in the film with Rick involved about the September the 11th attacks and whether or not you're some kind of loony to really question some of the big assumptions that we're being told about them. So let's have a listen to that now. And it's from Diane Jesse Miller's film One by One.
The only kind of building blocks that require the blocks from the side, it falls over at that point. But then explain to me how, when an aeroplane was flown into one of the Twin Towers on September the 11th, that building collapsed in on itself. Why the other tower? Scientifically, mathematically, but blockily, those buildings should have fallen over. Not inwards. I mean, I would concede the idea that by some sort of miracle one of those towers would have collapsed in on itself. But both of them? I'm afraid I doubted that the moment I watched it happen live. It is unconceivable that those planes brought those buildings there.
But watch a controlled demolition.
It looks the same. If a picture says 1,000 words, and our eyes can see 1,000 lies, see it to believe.
Who did that? Why would they?
Fear.
9/11, like 7/7, is pure fear. Nothing more.
September the 11th, 2001, was a ruse, a show, a charade that even a child could identify.
A charade, a child could identify. Well, what made you write about these things, Diane?
Well, 9/11 was something that I was quite passionate about. I think it was probably one of the first moments I started to realise that things weren't quite as we were led to believe they were in the world. I mean, I was just 21 when 9/11 happened. And I think anyone of my generation or above can tell you exactly where they were when it happened. It was our Kennedy, so to speak. And when I watched it, I mean, I'm quite a logical person, and I couldn't believe that the buildings didn't fall over. That just seemed like child's play to me, that if you've got a structure and you hit the side of it, it doesn't collapse in on itself, it falls over. I mean, I'm no engineer, I'm no scientist, I'm not a specialist about the 9/11 truth movement or anything like that. All I used for this scene was what my logic dictated. Like I said, it's a charade that even a child could see, and that's where that kind of came from.
Well, why haven't we seen it on our TV screens or on prime time on a Saturday night? Why haven't we seen it yet?
We've been trying. I mean, we started doing this film 7 years ago, and it's been a long, long, arduous process at times. And I mean, the film was actually finished in 2013, so 6 years this December, three years this December the film's been finished. We did submit to most of the major film festivals, sent it into TV stations and such like, and no one's kind of wanted to touch it. I mean, even after, God love him, even after Rick died, we, as a team, we decided that we weren't going to do any publicity for a month, kind of in respect of Rick. And but what did come out of that is that we weren't even put in any of the press after Rick died. It wasn't in, and there's nothing about our film in any of the body of work at all. I don't know is the answer,
but it's annoying, isn't it? I'd like to see it. I want to sit down on Saturday night and watch your film, and it seems to me as if there may be a sensitivity about the issues that Rick is bringing about there, even though he's one of the best loved comedians in the country. Have you actually had any real sort of conversations with commissioning editors and channel controllers and things that you can relate to us about the kinds of reasons they've given you that they don't want to show your film?
No, we've had nothing like that. I mean, we were lucky enough to find an independent distributor last year called Film Vault, who have kind of come on board and tried to use all their channels to get it in the door. And although there's been kind of negotiations, it's never kind of got anywhere. But I've never been privy to those conversations. So what I've been doing in the background is trying to get as many people wanting to see this film via social media, but it's just me trying to do it. So anyone that goes to our Facebook page will see we've got just over 1,500 people, and myself and my business partner Ash, we have been trying to build that audience up over the last 5 years. But I can't answer that. I can't help but feel there's something that's kind of not letting it get through the door, which is why we've gone for a DVD release, and we're doing it through kind of, we're ticking the boxes, if you like. We are putting in for official BBFC certification, which is like the 18 rating or 15 rating, so that if we want to put it into a mainstream store, we can do that. We've got everything in place to do so. And then there's really no excuses. I mean, there's no excuses not for a chain to take the DVD and put it on their shelves. So kind of, it's what we're working towards, but it's hard when you get no's constantly. You can only wonder if it's to do with not just the content of that scene, but the content of the whole film. I mean, our ethos and my whole idea when I wrote the film was to wake people up. I feel that there's lots of people in the truth and reason, for want of a better word, or debunkers that know about these things. And like I said, I'm no expert, but there are people out there that don't know anything about them. And that's one of the reasons why we wanted to create a drama film rather than a documentary, because I think people will sit down and watch a drama without really knowing necessarily the ideas behind it all. And maybe, just maybe, fingers crossed, they'll watch it and go, I don't quite agree with that. And then they'll use technology, or they'll read a book, or they'll go to a group and talk to people, much like the journey of Dion, the main character in the film. So kind of that's our hope. But I kind of went off topic there. I don't know, it's a short answer. I don't know why it hasn't been picked up. It is Rick's last major film, and no UK TV sets channels picked it up yet. I don't know, is the answer.
Did you actually have conversations with Rick about 9/11 and about the War on Terror?
Well, we had conversations about the script, obviously, and the story, and kind of the content of it. And he was, although he never directly said one way or the other what he believed on it, to me personally, he did say that there was kind of things weren't quite right. I mean, we all know Rick to be kind of a bit of an anarchist. I mean, you just got to look at the young ones for that sort of thing. So knowing Rick from doing the film, he wouldn't have done it if he didn't believe in it. Just because, like, he said to me, he used to get 100 scripts a week, and he would pick the ones he wanted to do, and my script spoke to him. So that has to say something, I think.
Yeah, I mean, also, of course, there's another film, the title slips my memory at the moment, which is out on general release, which is all about a terrorist attack on London, isn't there?
Oh, I don't know the answer to that, I'm afraid.
Yes, Martin, can we have a little bit of collective knowledge on this? Because there is, I think it's even number one at the moment in the cinemas.
Well, I'm not sure I even know which one you're talking about.
Oh, is it the London Has Fallen one that's kind of...
That sounds like it, yeah, that's the one, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there are lots of films in Hollywood that kind of start dealing with the War on Terror or conspiracy theories. I mean, you just got to look at Conspiracy Theory with Mel Gibson. I don't know if anyone's ever seen that, but the first 10 minutes of that are brilliant, and then they just Hollywoodize it. So, I mean, I think filmmakers do try to put it in their films, but I've made that statement, but it's a very sweeping one because I can't speak for other filmmakers.
How do people get hold of your film then, Jesse? If we can't see it on the telly, are we going to have to get a DVD, or can you get it on Netflix or something like that, or, you know, one of these online services?
It's not an online service. We did a 2-month online service to see what the audience was going to be like, and actually it went quite well. So we then have decided, in fact, on Monday, to do a crowdfunding campaign, because lots of the funds for the film were raised through crowdfunding and friends giving their hard-earned money to make this film possible. So we've started a crowdfunding campaign for a pre-order of DVDs. We started that, what day are we on? No, we started that on Wednesday, and we're already at 71%. So people can order a DVD there. It's £10 plus postage and packing, so it's kind of £2 to the UK, £5 to Europe, 5 World War, I can't remember off the top of my head. But yeah, you can go to our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/1by1themovie, and there's links all over there about pre-ordering your DVD.
So have you got your own sort of dedicated website for the film?
We have got a website, yeah, 1by1themovie.co.uk.
Also, Martin, it does make me think this about the wider film industry. I love old documentaries, and I was watching World in Action DVD Volume 4 of loads of old World in Action films. I sit and watch them, and there's nothing on the TV, which is most nights. I sit and watch one of those, and there was a fascinating one from the 70s about the death of the British film industry. And you do kind of wonder, don't you, the extent to which money kind of now is deciding which films get made and which films don't, on the basis of if the people with the money, if it fits their narrative and if it fits their agenda. So effectively living in a kind of vast propaganda world when we go to the cinemas.
Well, indeed, I think the people behind this film are to be congratulated, because obviously these are extremely difficult topics. I've obviously not seen the film, and I think it's a great coup to have somebody like Rick Mayall work with you on the film. And it does seem incredibly suspicious when Rick Mayall, after his sad demise, is all over the media and everybody was remembering him, that the fact that he'd made this film wasn't mentioned. And you would have thought that somebody would have picked that up and said, well, this has got to be a commercially viable things for us to pick up. And it does make you wonder. I mean, let's face it, if they did carry out 9/11 and it was an inside job, the people behind that are not going to be sitting on their hands allowing films to be made about it and allowing them to be distributed. That's the kind of people they would be, isn't it?
Okay, final word with you then, Diane Jessie Miller. Give us the best way to get hold of you, get hold of your film, and to watch it online, and I suppose to pay for it, because of course you are still in debt having made this film several years ago.
Yes, I'm still trying to recoup the cost, the money that was so graciously bestowed upon me to make the film. So that's what I mean. Selling 2,000 DVDs would mean that we'd break even, which would be amazing, because all the cast and crew pretty much worked for free on this because they believed in it. So I mean, the best way to get hold of myself or the film or anything to do with it is Facebook. We're on there 24/7 pretty much. So if you go to facebook.com/1by1themovie, all in words, no numbers, then you can like the page, send us a message. There's information on there about pre-ordering the DVD and stuff like that. So, and if anyone's got any questions or concerns, then you can just drop us a Facebook message and we'll get back to them as soon as we can.
Well, I think it's very commendable what you've done, and of course eventually what may happen if we can get over the first hurdles is that this becomes an underground classic, the sort of thing.
Oh, that'd be nice.
Well, wouldn't it be? Wouldn't it be? Because I mean, that's the way you go around this kind of blockage.
I think Martin,
eventually people go, have you seen this? And you get viral marketing, far better than the mainstream stuff.
Well, I'm sure it would have been very easy. It would have been easy for Diane to put it on YouTube and lots of people would watch it, but then it actually she wouldn't have actually been able to make a commercial success. And if she does, then of course she can maybe make another film.
Well,
in a way, Martin has made the most important point of the evening, I think. Sorry, Diane, but is that in any kind of normal real world, anybody should look at this and think, wow, this is an absolute money spinner because Rick has just died. I mean, it sounds cynical, but this is what music industry, the entertainment industry does all the time. What do you put it down to? Why haven't they done it, Diana?
I don't know. I literally don't know. And I mean, I do hope that people get to watch it. And like you said about the money, I mean, I'm not looking to make money from it. If I was looking to make money from it, I would have got out years ago. It's about getting the film out there to people. And the reason we want people to pay for things like this is so that other films can get made. I mean, all this is about investing their money into this project. Won't give it again unless they get it back, if that makes sense. So it's that kind of thing that's why we want people to buy it and not just stick it on YouTube or anything like that. So I know that there's still going to be people that don't agree necessarily with my standpoint on that, but I hope they can understand where I'm coming from.
I think it's a great subject you're dealing with as well, because these sorts of issues can even sort of split families up, can't they? Some people sort of so divided about this that they say, right, goodbye, I'm not talking to you again, and that's it. Families, couples, and this is something that we're not really getting through the mainstream media at all, this understanding that the way that the war on terror and the sort of post-2001 paradigm can affect the way we live our lives.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I repeat again, well done for what you've done so far. I perfectly understand why you don't want it to be just banged up on YouTube. And
thank you.
if you can break the barrier with what you're doing now, eventually it could be an underground classic which will overwhelm the mainstream, because that's what ultimately happens. I'd love to see it. You might be want to. Presumably, people can see clips of it at some point, because we used a clip earlier. We need, you know, we need to get people out there who are already on the program to get this out there, so that people who are not on the program
can be
exposed to it.
Was Vinny down in Shepton Mallet had actually bought a copy and then filmed a crucial bit from it on his phone off the TV and then put that onto YouTube. So you don't mind about things like that, do you, Di?
No, I don't want the whole film going up. I mean,
that's unreasonable.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, there is such a thing as a fair usage, and I totally understand that. It's more the whole film. And, I mean, we've got three trailers up online that we've made to kind of get people's appetite. And, I mean, if you go to I've got my own website, dianejessiemiller.co.uk. I've got two scenes from the film in my showreel. One about the DVLA and North Rebellion, which not many people have seen, so come check that one out. I want people to see it. That's why I made it. I didn't make a film to sit it in a box and not let the world see it. I mean, the work in it, the storylines in it, and the theories, although, like I said, I'm not an expert, there's things that need to get out there, and I want to start a debate. That's why I made this film, and I think
it's also fair to say that Rick wanted to get that debate started, and so we're hopefully being part of that right now. So it's one by one, the movie.co.uk. Mm-hmm. I would recommend that rather than Facebook, even though you said you're on there 24 hours, 24/7, you never get any sleep.
Along with the CIA.
Absolutely.
And so more power to your elbow, Diane. And
thank you very much, Tony.
Thanks very much for joining us on the Politics Show today.
Thank you very much. Take care, and I'll speak to you again.
The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Martin, let's move on now to look at some of our other topics this evening. And I suppose the first one that comes to mind is this business of the deal done at the beginning of the week with between the Turks and Angela Merkel for the European Union. At the beginning of the day, on Monday, I think it was, I heard a figure of €3 billion, which the Turkish government are going to get of our taxpayers' money in exchange for several tens of thousands of migrants being swapped. Now, the migrants, some and refugees coming from Turkey to Greece, and an equal number going back from Greece to Turkey. I couldn't understand really why €3 billion of our money should go for something like that. And then later in the day, I hear it's going to be €6 billion.
Well, I mean, all sorts of ordure is hitting the fan at this moment, isn't it? I mean, the fact is, if people have a legitimate reason to seek asylum inside the European Union, and they've got a legitimate reason, and therefore you've got no reason to turn them back. And if they haven't got a legitimate reason, then they haven't got a legitimate reason. But of course, what's happening here is the politicisation of the refugee flow from Turkish territory. Now, at the beginning of the war, which Turkey was very, very very important role in starting the war in Syria, although the British intelligence services clearly played a hand, as did the Americans, the Saudis, etc. They were quite keen to have refugees cross the border from Syria into Turkey, because in those refugee camps they were recruiting the militants who were then being armed and trained and sent back over the border to fight the Syrian army. And of course, British military personnel were probably working with their Turkish NATO counterparts on that mission. But of course, what then happened at a certain stage is that the Turks encouraged people in the refugee camps in Turkey, because most people around the world, when they flee across a border, flee across the most immediate border. There are more people internally displaced inside Syria than have left Syria. Most of them have fled to government government-controlled areas. Government controls about 80% of the population now, because people have fled from the rebel-controlled areas into government-controlled areas to escape from the rebels.
But what we're really talking about here is Turkey, isn't it? And yeah. There's already been questions about this deal with Merkel, because with people saying, well, actually, you can't send people from Greece back to Turkey because Turkey's got such an appalling human rights record, it would be illegal to do so. It would actually be a criminal act to send someone to that sort of regime.
Law. I mean, if somebody's got a legitimate reason for seeking asylum in Greece, you've got no right
to send
them back
Merkel
to Turkey.
So what was Merkel thinking of doing this deal? I mean, there was talk about it being blackmail.
What's going on here is that Erdogan has basically, his gamble that he could overthrow Assad with the support of Saudi Arabia and the Western intelligence services through ISIS and Daesh and the other Al-Nusra Front and the other groups within Turkey, within Syria that they've been supporting, and bringing in loads of jihadi fighters from Libya, for example, like Abdul Hakim Belhaj, head of the Islamic Fighting Group of Libya, which we mentioned earlier, who ends up being the Free Syrian Army. The Turks are now, their gamble has failed. Assad is pretty firmly in charge of most of the population of Syria. And
so
now,
how are they in the position to demand 6 billion of our euros from Angela Merkel?
Because they could say, well, we're going to kick all these refugees out and you can deal with it. And of course, Greece and Turkey have got a pretty bad relationship anyway. So from Turkey's point of view, sending a load of refugees to Greece to put pressure on the Greek government that they don't like anyway, even though they're both supposedly members of NATO, it doesn't, you know, it's basically part of Turkey's asserting itself and chucking its weight around. And of course, the Turks are in a position to push refugees towards Western Europe unless they are bribed not to. And that's what this is. It's a big bribe to Erdogan not to push the refugees towards the European Union. Now, of course, he's also fighting a war against his own Kurdish population inside Turkey. Hundreds of people are being killed in the last few weeks, mostly civilians, by airstrikes, incidentally, against so-called terrorist targets inside Turkey, inside Iraq. And they're shelling over the border the Kurdish militias on the other side of the border. In other words, the war in Syria is spreading to Turkey, the war in Turkey is spreading to the European Union, and we're all going to war because we like war, don't we? That's why we invaded Iraq in 2003, because we wanted a war. And that war isn't over, it's hardly started, as we said at the time.
Yes, all this talk, I was listening to Min Campbell on the way in today, around about 4:30 on 5 Live, saying, oh, it was all unintended consequences. I don't believe a word of it being unintended consequences. I think that everybody, most people in the country, I think 3 million marched in London, didn't they? To say, don't do this. Most of the country knew. The politicians seemed you didn't have a clue. Anyway, you're talking about Turkish terrorists there and the Turkish government attacking them. One bunch of terrorists,
so-called terrorists, run
a newspaper, apparently, according to Erdogan. And just as a close of play, as we were closing our show this time last week, so a whole bunch of riot police turned up at the Today's Zaman newspaper, which is the biggest newspaper in Turkey, just so happens to have been digging an immense amount of dirt on the present government, on Erdogan, and particularly on his son Bilal.
Well, indeed. I mean, the two stories which they pursued, which are most interesting, is that they uncovered that Libyan sarin was being smuggled into Syria by the Turkish
intelligence services, precursors to nerve gas, in
order to carry out the Ghouta chemical weapons attack, which was then blamed on Assad
in 2013.
Yes, this was all covered by Seymour Hersh, the investigative journalist from the US, in the London Review of Books, because the New York Review of Books wouldn't publish his work, even though he's a very well established journalist. And the other thing that they covered was that Turkish police officers, civilian police officers, stopped a convoy of weaponry going into Syria, packed with weaponry, and the people who were driving the trucks were all working for MIT, the Turkish intelligence services. They arrested the people concerned, but now what's happened is the police officers who carried out that raid, which basically showed that that ISIS was being supported by NATO, by Turkey, they have been put on trial for treason, and the journalists who covered the whole thing are also being put on trial for treason, and they used to work for Zaman, which is this opposition newspaper, which Erdogan has now tried to close down.
Anyway, yesterday evening I managed to get hold of the executive editor of the English language edition of today's Zaman, and I think if you wanted to look at some of those stories, they may still just about be on the one of the caches, the Google cache or Yahoo caches, because one of the first things that the Erdogan government and the police did when they arrived at the building and took over the building last Friday night was to start removing the archive. I mean, their digital archive is one of the most important, useful pieces of information there is on the Middle East.
Well, you've got to ask, why are they attacking these people now? And it's because, of course, they have basically broken the story that NATO is the supporter of the supplier of ISIS, and also probably NATO intelligence services were implicated in the chemical weapons attack at Ghouta, which Obama said was a red line and that the world would have to do something about it. What if it turns out that NATO were behind the killing of those hundreds of people?
So the story...
The world's got to do something about it. What are we going to do?
So the story... Okay, Martin. The story, it really starts last Friday night with Erdogan, but it ends with our own government.
Indeed, because of course they are part of the integrated structure of NATO's military command, and we are implicated in the chemical weapons attack in Ghouta. Not we, the British people, through our political representatives who supposedly control our armed forces and security services.
So anyway, let's have a listen now to today's Zaman's English executive editor, Sevgey Akalsamy, and I spoke to her last night.
Last Friday, the Turkish government's largest newspaper of Turkey, Zaman, which includes an English daily, the allegation is aiding terrorist organizations and being a part of the terrorist propaganda. I completely deny such nonsense arguments. No print house, printing house, no print institution or media institution could be seized by the government. So currently the government violating the constitution. There is not a single evidence of terrorist links of our newspaper. This is a completely politically motivated move to silence all critical voices. And Erdogan has been using his card, terrorism charges, to silence opponents and critics. Let me clarify, Erdogan is actually not the head of the government, but the head of the state. He's supposed to be an impartial president, but he acts as if he is the head of the governing party, AKP. And he has been acting on behalf of them. And there is a puppet government, which only follows orders of Erdogan. So effectively, Erdogan is the only person that rules Turkey. There's a one-man rule at the moment. It's true that they have significant popular support. Why do they have popular support, you might ask? Thanks to the huge media machine that the government has established over the years, directly and indirectly, the government owns or controls most of the TV stations and newspapers, plus people who benefit from the welfare state that Erdogan introduced in the country for the first time. People care about their economic well-being and do not care about freedoms and violation of human rights. Having this popular support behind him, Erdogan thinks that he is able to do whatever he wants, and the Western world also turns a blind eye to whatever is going on, to whatever he is doing to silent critics. The government wants to hide anything about corruption investigation. They have been even before destroying the digital archives, they were sending court orders to our newspapers to remove anything about the massive corruption investigation that implicates Erdogan and his family. So another story that they removed recently after they took over the newspaper was relevant to the witch hunt against the business people. The government has been suppressing business people, academics, journalists have been arbitrarily detained or arrested. And when we wanted to run such a story for Monday, for our Monday issue, the new administration removed it, replaced it with something else. They have been scared of anybody who would like to talk about corruption and violation of rule of law in the country. There are certain allegations regarding possible alleged links of Turkish authorities with the ISIL and their oil trade.
So what's it like as a journalist finding suddenly that you can't write what you want to write?
I felt during the police raid, I felt as if I was being raped, to be honest, because they forcefully entered my workplace. Even though I am one of the executives leading today's amount, the police physically obstructed me from our executive floor, from our buildings. They forced me out. One of them grabbed my cell phone and stopped my broadcast on Periscope, for instance. So it was pretty brutal, pretty shameful. I was embarrassed on behalf of my country. It's such a shame. And they have changed my life almost overnight. It's like a trauma. And most of us will be unemployed soon. Nearly 2,000 journalists are expecting to be unemployed, and more importantly, maybe they also took over the largest privacy that has a reputation for monitoring the elections in Turkey. Right now, with the seizure of that news agency, it's only the state news agency that is going to that is covered. So if government seems to have 90% of the votes, we cannot against it. We cannot argue anything against it based on conflicting results from any other source. So that's pretty alarming for Turkish democracy.
What do you think this means for the Middle East? Because Turkey is such an important player in that part of the world.
Good question. Actually, everybody overlooked this part in my interviews. Everybody asked what this means for the EU, etc. For the Middle East, I think it's a huge disappointment because Turkey was a shining star a decade ago. It was a source of inspiration in many Muslim societies because AKP, at least in the beginning, showed that democracy and Islam could reconcile, could coexist, are compatible. And that's one of the reasons I supported this government as well. I just thought, see, political Islam is could turn into, real Democrats. But unfortunately, they have been disappointing me along with everybody else. People are losing faith in the belief that a Muslim elected religious government could also be democratic, and that's so shameful because I think it is the only Muslim democratic country in the region. Turkey lost its chances to sort of glow and be the poster child of the Middle East.
That's Sevgey Arkasemi, and probably pronounced that wrong, but anyway, she's the executive editor of the English edition of today's Zaman, which was stormed by the Turkish police, the Turkish government of Erdogan, and the AKP party this time last Friday. Martin, it's, it is immensely important, isn't it, what happened, because as she pointed out there, they've not only closed down this investigative journalism that's been going on into the president, they've also, in one fell swoop, also destroyed this organisation which provided independent monitoring of elections in Turkey.
Yeah, I think that's right. And as I said before the clip, why has this happened and why now? And I think it's because the cat's out of the bag. What Zaman were doing was incredibly important, which was exposing the Turkish government's role in supporting ISIS through buying their oil and selling it on mainly to the Israelis. Of course, Bilal Erdogan, the son of the president, being very much implicated in that.
Well, he was in exile for a while over in Italy because it was too hot for him in Turkey.
Well,
apparently he's just coming back.
Well, the magistrates in Bologna want to extradite him, in fact, for various criminal offences in Italy. Now, in other words, they're exposing the general corruption around the Erdogan regime, but the two things which are really significant that they'd managed to expose was A, NATO's role in supplying the sarin for the chemical weapons attack at Ghouta, which means that we are implicated in that attack, and the other, of course, is that the ISIS were being supplied with weaponry by MIT, the Turkish intelligence.
What Erdogan has done here is use the judicial process, which does rather suggest that maybe like places like Egypt, that in Turkey the judiciary is itself totally corrupt.
I think the fact that the Turkish police initially raided the convoy taking weaponry to ISIS shows that there is actually a struggle for a rule of law in Turkey, as there is elsewhere in the world. And I don't think Turkey's a particularly corrupt place compared to other Western countries.
It also shows how important the mainstream media is. And if you haven't got a mainstream media that can ask questions, as Michael Crick did this week about the Conservative government defrauding election expenses, you don't have a democracy.
Well, you don't. And of course, Erdogan would still probably have... Erdogan's got significant political support in Turkey. He's got virtually no political support in the Kurdish regions of Turkey. That would be very similar, for example, to the Serbian government having plenty of support in Belgrade and no support in Pristina in Kosovo,
I suppose,
for example.
The other side of this is, you know, the extent to which... I mean, we were talking about the BBC earlier. Mainstream media actually is in, you know, runs things because it decides which issues get aired and which don't.
It does, but I think it's not just up
which
to
which people get a voice and who doesn't.
Well, I think it's important that everybody gets a voice through the mainstream media or not, but the more mainstream the media is that puts forward serious allegations, the more seriously they are taken. But it may well be, you see, that Erdogan closing down Zaman means that people are asking the question, well, why is he closing them down? And I think it's very important that we are making it clear why he's closing them down. It's not just because they're mildly critical of him, it's because they're pointing the finger at him for A, supporting ISIS militarily, and B, supporting them financially, and that the evidence is piling up. Now, Erdogan is part of NATO. He works with British intelligence services, because we're all on the same side in the war in Syria. So we're also implicated in this. It's not just a matter for the Turks.
You can listen again to any shows at bcfmradio.com.
And leave comments about your favourite programmes.
BCFM 93.2, your interactive station, 24 hours a day.
And another item I said at the top of the hour, Martin, two big anniversaries of great British cover-ups. 30 years since the 1986 assassination of Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme. So what do you make of that? I know that we were discussing, I think it was last week, wasn't it, about the use of the Royal Navy to destabilise Sweden. And actually, do you think Sweden really is neutral, as we're told?
Well, there's been a documentary that's came out on Arte TV, which is a French-German mainstream TV channel, recently. And the allegations in that documentary were, firstly, that Olof Palme, who was at the... Sweden was supposedly an independent. Olof Palme was supposedly neutral. Olof Palme was a social democrat leader of Sweden with a relatively, you know, anti-Cold War views. And when he came to power, what the documentary alleges, is that then immediately what seemed to be happening is that Russian submarines were infiltrating Swedish territorial waters, Olof Palme was put on the defensive. His own navy, the allegation in the film, that his own navy was actually working with the Americans and the Royal Navy to fake Russian submarine penetration of the Swedish territorial waters. So the Royal Navy were implicated in this. So when we're talking about linkages and so on, that means that your taxes, dear listeners, were being used to undermine and overthrow a democratically elected government in a friendly country.
It all came at a very crucial stage with what was going on in the Soviet Union, didn't it? And the fall of the Berlin Wall.
It did, because Gorbachev was coming to power. Palme was going to meet with Gorbachev, but he never got there because he was assassinated. And the implication is that NATO intelligence services, probably through the Gladio networks, had Palme assassinated. And of course, the fact that the Royal Navy and the Americans were using their submarines as a means of trying to destabilise him before they assassinated him definitely puts them in the frame for the assassination. Now, that's the real world we live in. And eventually, of course, a documentary is made, a serious documentary, which is shown late at night on TV in France and Germany, but of course it's not the sort of thing you're going to hear at the top of the hour on the Murdoch News at 6 or 7 when we go off air. But the fact is, it's out there. The stuff's all out there, and all you need to do is get on a computer and you can chase it down for yourself, folks, which is what this show's all about.
Well, we can also help you out by putting some links from our show page on thisweek.org.uk. On to the Dunblane murders, Martin. This was 20 years ago up in Scotland. The One of the main things that fascinated me about looking into this was that there was a very accusation from one of the top Freemasons in Scotland that the guy was a paedophile, and that also that he'd received some sort of Masonic protection. That there was actually people in the police who were protecting him, and although that the official advice was that he should have his guns taken away because he was unstable, and he was also possibly procuring pictures of young boys as part of a paedophile ring, that he should be allowed to keep his gun.
Well, I understand that George Robertson, the former head of NATO, was in the same Freemason's lodge with this fellow, and had signed the firearm certificate, character reference, which allowed him to get a shotgun, which is then, of course, he then used to kill all of those children and their teacher.
Well, there's a journalist called Marcello Mega who wrote an article about this in December 2003, and he said a top Scottish Freemason, former Grand Master Lord Burton, said that Lord Cullen's inquiry into the Dunblane massacre was an enormous cover-up, that these high-profile legal figures belonged to a secretive super-Masonic group called the Speculative Society. Anyway, it certainly doesn't look as if real people who were responsible for this, because he certainly wasn't just acting on his own, he had some form of establishment protection, will ever be brought to book.
Well, the suspicion has to be, the copper's hunch, because obviously I haven't carried out an investigation of this, is that NATO intelligence services, don't forget Robertson ends up as the head of NATO, and it might be very handy for certain people, for the head of NATO, to be compromised by having paedophile connections. And I think that's the real iceberg underlying all of this VIP paedophilia. The intelligence services, NATO intelligence services, the ones we've been accusing of fomenting terrorism in earlier parts of this show, have also used paedophilia as a means of blackmail. So what you do, what the suggestion is that this fellow was running, he had a boat on the Loch Lomond, he was taking senior politicians there to have sex with underage boys, all of which was being filmed by the CIA. And of course that then means that those politicians will do as they're told when they become, for example, head of NATO.
And also, of course, if any of these top politicians are closely associated with a known paedophile, that means they're easier to blackmail.
Well, indeed, and that's the point, is this isn't just random. It's not just that psychopaths at the top of the social hierarchy like having sex with underage boys and girls. It's also a strategy to dirty them all up and make sure they do as they're told. And that's what was behind the De True affair in Belgium. And I think that that's what we'll find is at the bottom of the VIP paedophilia scandals in this country.
Don't think we'll have time for John Lennon, I'm afraid. But before we go, the £200 million that Winston Churchill managed to procure for the atom bomb at the end of the Second World War. I spoke to the author of Churchill's Bomb on our Dialect show, dialectradio.co.uk, earlier this week. That's Graham Farmerlow, who wrote the book Churchill's Bomb, about this mystery money that appeared for Churchill to make the bomb with, even though the money didn't come through Parliament.
This will be a revelation for many people that the British atomic bomb, which emerged in the early 50s, was developed with money from outside somehow. They went round Parliament.
Well, it was 100 million by the time Churchill, just over 100 million by the time he became Prime Minister, which was October 51. So, please don't quote me, but there will be the exact figure somewhere, but my rough guess would be something like 200 million. It would be billions of pounds.
In today's money, actually, it would be around about 7 billion, Martin.
Well, yes, and the question is, where did he get it from? And if people want to find out that, they'll have to listen to future parts of future versions of this show. We do have our theories where that money came from, do we not?
Well, certainly, yes, from Martin Bormann, Nazi money that Churchill had been doing deals with. But there's also this allegation that Winston Churchill wanted a first strike on Moscow in 1950. I asked him about that too. This is Graham Farmerlow, the author of Churchill's Bomb.
Yes, and I must say some Churchill experts did not believe me. I give two references in the book, and I found another one later, right? So I consider that, and I think most people, they accepted, actually, to be fair, they did back down. The correct way to put it is that Churchill, in private, urged a first strike on Moscow. That is correct. Right? He did not do it in public, but he did in private.
What was the purpose of that? Why was he thinking like that? Surely you didn't want to start World War III just as soon as World War II had finished.
So that you could ask that question. His reasoning at the time was that Russia was so dangerous that the only way to stop it taking over Eastern Europe, right, was to do something that would be a dramatic gestures, not the wrong word, but take a dramatic action. So there we are. Churchill's not here to defend himself, but he, as I said, we have clear evidence, right, that three times, as I say, to my certain knowledge, people heard him say, right, that we should attack Moscow straight up.
Graham Farmelow there, the author of Churchill's Bomb. You can hear the rest of that interview online at www.dialectradio.co.uk. Time to sign off now. The Murdoch News at 7, followed by Arabian Nights with Mohammed Mokawi. Thanks to all our guests today. thisweek.org.uk takes you straight to this show's links in our archives. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Wishing you